So after doing some research on the G7 summit and what your role is as part of the PML, we'd like to know more about your work on artificial life in coastal ecosystems.
The artificial light experiment. Okay, so I'm actually going to a big meeting about that this afternoon, but as soon as I leave you, I'm going on to our annual meeting. So we have a big experiment running at the moment, in fact, at Plymouth Marine Laboratory, where I have just under 700 animals in the lab.
Yeah.
So 300 dog whelps, 300 mussels, and 60 crabs, and they will sit under experimental conditions for a year. So it started beginning of May, and it will run until the end of May next year. And essentially what we're doing is we have all of these animals sitting under different artificial light treatments. So we have, we've replicated daylight for them. So we have the sun goes up in the morning, goes down in the evening, and then at night we have different levels of artificial light sitting on them. Some of them are under very low artificial light levels. Some of them are under quite high artificial light levels. And the idea is we want to see how this changes, first of all, how they grow and how they reproduce. Because a lot of marine animals take their cues from moonlight, particularly. So when it's time for them to spawn and breed, quite often the phases of the moon will play a big part in that. If they move up and down through the water at night to feed, so they spend the day on the bottom and they travel up through the water column at night to the surface to feed, they'll follow the moon to do that, like moths do. And because our coasts are getting brighter and brighter and brighter because we're building on them and we've got street lights and bars on the waterfront and stuff like that, it's starting to interfere with how they're responding to natural light cues. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at that by keeping them under these artificial light conditions for a year. So we'll look at kind of really basic stuff like how much they're eating, how much they grow and how quickly they grow, whether or not they survive until the end of the experiment. I mean, if they're really stressed out by being lit all the time, sometimes it's enough to kill them.
Oh, yeah.
So we're looking at that in terms of kind of basic physiological type stuff, but we're also looking at how it affects behavior. So the three animals that I have, we've got the mussels, which are at the bottom of my little miniature food chain. The dog whelps will eat the mussels and the crabs will eat the dog whelps if they were out on the rocky shore. So we're seeing if how they interact with each other changes because they're sat under bright lights all the time. So are the dog whelps more willing to go out and find the mussels because they're easier to find because they can see them better? Are the crabs finding it easier to find the dog whelps because they can see them better? But also, because the crabs can find the dog whelps more easily, does that mean actually that the dog whelps spend more time hiding from the crabs and less time feeding on the mussels? So there's some quite complex interactions that we're trying to get a handle on. And we're hoping that this experiment will help us figure it out. It's quite a new field of study, actually, artificial light. So it's quite nice to be at the forefront of it. But I'll be honest, it's not the easy experiment to get set up. Because when you're dealing with light, you have to make sure that everything else is dark. Because if you get any kind of light from outside drifting into my experiment, then I don't really know if the light levels are right. So I do all of my work in the dark at the moment. So I have a completely dark lab, and I have to have a torch to check my animals. I've got a red torch to check my animals because the red won't interfere with them. It's the white light that we're interested in. So I spend quite a lot of time in total darkness with a tiny red head torch peering at animals through a curtain. It's not very glamorous.
Yeah. So what about with temperatures and stuff? Does that have any effects as well?
Yeah, temperature. I mean, most marine animals, except for the mammals, obviously, are cold-blooded, so they can't regulate their own body temperature. So the temperature of the water is basically the temperature your animals are at. So yes, that will always make a difference. So we have our animals are under temperature control as well, so we can change the temperature in the room based on what the water temperature is at the moment. So we have a study site about 10 miles off Plymouth. It's called L4. I don't know why it's called L4, but it's our study site. We monitor it every week. PML monitors it every week, and we just set our experimental conditions to the temperature of the water out there because we get regular updates on that. We get once a week, we know what temperature the water is, so we will just change it over the course of the year. So I think our animals at the moment are sat at about 10 degrees C. By the summer, they'll probably be sat at 15 or 16 degrees C. So we would expect once the water starts to get warmer, the mussels especially will probably start spawning, which will be a big mess. But we just have, I mean, we want them to do it. It means they're kind of settled into the experimental system, but that's going to be a lot of work when they start spawning.
Yeah.
Right. Nice. Cool.
When you started your career, did you expect to be in the line of work that you're in today?
No, actually. So when I went to university the first time around, so I went to university at 18, and I did humanities and drama at university, and I trained to be an actress. So I actually did that for 10 years. I was in my late 20s before I decided that I wasn't actually getting very much work as an actress at all. And so mostly what I was doing was kind of working front of house and in box offices at theatres and stuff, which I didn't really like doing. So I decided that I needed a career change, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. So to help me decide, I did a volunteer project in Mexico. I did a marine conservation volunteer project for 4 months, and I lived on a beach, which was lovely. And I learned to scuba dive, and we were monitoring the coral reef off this beach at Mexico, and I got totally hooked. I didn't grow up by the sea, so marine conservation was never really on my radar until I did this project at 28. And after that, I thought, this is actually what I want to do. So I decided to go back into education at 28 to do it. But I thought, when I went back to university, I thought that I was going to be a coral biologist, actually. I wanted to live in the tropics and dive on coral reefs every day, really. That's what I thought that I'd end up doing. But as I went, when I went back to university, I just got interested in other things over the course of my degree. Sorry, my dog's barking because the doorbell's just rung. when I went back to university, I got more interested in benthic invertebrates, so the animals that live on the seafloor, especially crabs. I do love a crab, I have to say.
Yeah.
And so that's what I ended up studying. So I did my PhD on a kind of swimming crab that we find just off the coast of Plymouth, and now I work with invertebrates and intertidal animals rather than coral. Excuse me. So yeah, I live in Plymouth rather than the Caribbean, but that's all right. So yeah, I didn't really expect my career path to be quite what it has been. But I mean, you kind of have to be open to the experience. I don't think anybody who starts marine biology actually ends up studying what they think they're going to study, because they find other stuff while they're doing their degree. You find a lot of people starting marine biology degrees that want to work with whales and dolphins and stuff like that, or sharks, kind of your big charismatic animals. And then they suddenly discover that plankton and molecular biology is a thing, and they just go absolutely nuts for that, for working with really, really tiny animals. So
nice. Okay. So during your time working at the marine, in the marine environment, have any of your aims or goals changed?
Have my aims or goals changed? I think I got into it because, I mean, I was curious about it for a start, but also the marine environment has an enormous amount of pressure on it. And we still know, we don't know as much about it as we do as kind of the stuff that's happening on land. So we're lagging behind terrestrial biology a little bit. And part of that is because the sea is much, much harder to sample than the land is. I mean, there's just more of it. And it's wet, and that just makes everything more complicated. So I think when I started, I just wanted to know more about the marine environment and how the stuff that lives in it responds to the environment and how they interact with each other. And I think I'm still doing that, which is brilliant. I'm not working with the animals I thought that I would be working with. And I'm not always working in the field that I thought I'd be working with. I mean, I thought when I started that I'd be doing kind of pure climate change research. So warming temperatures, ocean acidification, deoxygenation, that kind of thing. And at the moment I've got a big project looking at artificial light, which I never thought that I'd be doing that. But I don't think my aims have changed, and I think I'm still doing what I expected to be doing, if maybe on slightly different projects.
Nice. Okay.
What could our generation do to assist in keeping our coastlines healthy?
Oh, that's a massive question. And I think it's not just about your generation. I think we all have a responsibility to do it. I think too often people of my age and older kind of pass the buck and say, well, it's your problem now, so off you go, crack on. So I don't think it's just you. But I think I think there's been a huge, huge shift towards society more broadly listening to younger people. I think Greta Thunberg has done a huge amount to raise the profile of climate change activism, and to bring to the fore the idea that people of your generation are interested and engaged and passionate and articulate and have something to say and want politicians and world leaders to actually do something about it. And I think it's kind of that level of demand. I think if we can keep that up, the profile has to stay high, because it's really easy for everybody to kind of make these promises and set these targets and then never meet them. There's big fanfare when we get these new targets announced. You know, we're going to limit it to 1.5 degrees C warming. There's going to be 30% of the marine environment protected by 2030. And these are brilliant targets, but they have to be met. And they are always. So I think to keep the profile high by continuing to get involved with stuff like the G7, to use the social media and stuff like that, to organize and communicate, I think is what needs to happen, actually, because I think these are big problems, and they can't be solved at an individual level. Everybody can do their bit to reduce their carbon footprint or to use less plastic, and that's brilliant, but it needs genuine, sustained political will to make the big changes. And that a lot of that is just about kind of holding your representatives' feet to the fire a little bit by continuing to badger them about these issues. And that's not just down to you, that's down to everybody.
Yeah. Well, if you possess the power of those in the G7 summit, what would your approach be to overcome the destruction of coastal marine environment?
The destruction of the coastal marine environment, oh God, I mean, I think a lot of it is about, it has to be sensible planning for a start. I mean, people want to live by the sea and they want to go out by the sea, and that's lovely. But you can't just whack up hotels and restaurants everywhere, because there are organisms that already live there. And we have to look after them. So I think sustainable and sensible planning is a big part of it. I think engagement with local communities is a massive part of it as well. I mean, I guess particularly in the Southwest, there's a lot of tourism is a huge part of the economy in the Southwest. And so there's people that want hotels, they want luxury holiday lets, they want second homes, they want nice places to go out. But I think there's people that live here.
Yeah. And
a lot of the time you go to these fishing villages, which are very, very popular with tourists, and it's really difficult for the locals because they can't afford to get on the housing ladder. Everything is geared for the tourists, so their schools and their post offices are closing because nobody lives there for most of the year. And so I think for coastal development and coastal economy and pressure on the coast, certainly from tourism, I think engagement with local communities is really, really important. As to it has to work for everybody. So the people that live there, as well as the people that want to visit. I mean, in terms of other pressures on the coastal environment that aren't just local, in terms of climate change, which is a global issue. Again, I mean, this is about negotiation, and it has to be global negotiation. And that's why it's difficult, because we have these very wealthy Western nations like us in the US kind of dictating terms to developing nations, saying that they have to cut their carbon emissions when we're actually not doing very much to cut ours. And so I think it's about negotiation in good faith to set targets that everybody can agree to, and that's actually achievable for everybody as well. But I mean, the biggest issue with climate change mitigation is that our political system runs in 5-year cycles. It's the term of parliament. And combating climate change requires long-term commitment, and it can't just be successive governments saying this is what we're going to do over the next 5 years. It has to be the political classes saying this is what we're going to do over the next 20 years, and everybody getting on board with it, instead of one government junking the last government's target, and then the next government junking the previous government's target. And it's not a simple issue to solve. I wish it was, but it's not. But it does require genuine commitment from all parties. And I think if I had that power, I would be driving for that, to say that this is a long-term commitment that we all have to agree to, regardless of your political stripes. That's the big challenge.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that, actually. Yeah, that makes sense.
I think also it's difficult because you see all these world leaders coming down, and they're focusing on climate change and stuff like that, but yet they have to build all these new places on the coast to house the security and stuff that they need. So it's kind of a little bit like you want to do something about it, but it's hard to because there's so much to think about.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. And I think part of the problem with climate change is almost the way our global economy runs, is that it's basically built on endless consumption and endless growth. Well, we don't have endless resources to support that. And so I think you hear a lot about the differences between, you know, it's the free market economy and everything is about competition and the markets regulate themselves. Well, they're a man-made thing. And I think if climate change is genuinely going to be curbed, I think we really need to rethink how our economy runs and how we measure how well economies are doing. So at the moment it's on GDP, right? It's about how much we produce and how much we consume. And I think there's a push, particularly from parties on the left, to start looking at kind of indices of well-being, you know, how well people are doing in terms of, do they have to have three jobs to make ends meet, three jobs at 80 hours a week, or can they do it on a, you know, a couple of people working 9 to 5? Is that enough for people to get by on? And how they're doing in terms of their health or their mental health, how much access they have to green spaces or coastal spaces, stuff like that. And I think if you can start getting those indices into your kind of into how your economy is measured, that could do quite a lot, because it would push us away from this consumption model. But again, that takes a phenomenal amount of political will to do that, because it's basically setting yourself against the way everything has run for, well, 60 years, kind of post-war, really, this consumption model started. So it's a huge, huge effort. But I think awareness of it is being raised, I think. The campaigners like Extinction Rebellion are doing an awful lot to get this kind of stuff on the radar. And I think over the past 5 or 6 years with Twitter and social media, I think has made a huge difference with how well we can organise and how well we can communicate. And the kind of access you have as well to political leaders, because you can kind of tweet at them directly. And if you can get enough people tweet storming, it can be quite effective in terms of at least getting an acknowledgement of the issue.